Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back.
Welcome to The Afterglow. Today we welcome Rebecca Higgs, from brooding musician to inspiring designer. She's now known as DIY Mom. She's no stranger when it comes to renovations, both professionally and personally. Growing up with parents that flipped houses before flipping was trendy, Rebecca developed an eye for design at an early age. During her years at Acadia University, Rebecca was known as the Trailer Park Martha Stewart for her crafty creations. After moving to Toronto, her days were spent working as a waitress while her nights were spent performing with her band. That was until an unexpected pregnancy led a then 31-year-old Rebecca to return to her hometown of Halifax, Nova Scotia, with her infant daughter. Since then, Rebecca has thrust herself into a multitude of career changes centering around her interests in film and television. On the pursuit of building her daughter a better future, Rebecca quite literally turned to building in all definitions of the word, from building stylish spaces through home renovation to building her brand as a rapidly growing influencer. There's no limit to what heights she can achieve. Welcome, Rebecca.
Well, we're really excited to talk to you and meet you.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
So should we just kind of like dive into, you know, all the nitty gritty secrets and stuff about your life and you know, how it all began. So you grew up in Nova Scotia and Halifax and you're living back there again. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was born in Halifax and raised here and did spend some time in Toronto, but came back to Nova Scotia after my daughter was born.
And so what was that like growing up, like when you were little and, you know?
Well, yeah. You know, Nova Scotia is a great place to grow up. I came from a very musical family. All of my cousins were here, spent a lot of time with my mom's family. My mom's from Halifax originally as well, but my dad is from the UK. I was raised in a evangelical Christian family. So we spent a lot of time at church and we, you know, we sang together as a family. We were involved. My parents were really, really involved in the church. And, we went to services three times on Sundays. You know, it was like
the morning meeting,
the regular meeting, the evening meeting. And then as I, as we grew up, my parents were directors of camp. So I spent a lot of time at camp and I have an older sister and a younger brother. So a lot of family time when we were little. And then as we grew up, like my parents always took us on these, sort of like mission trip vacations. So we never just went on like a regular family vacation. It had to be something with a purpose. And so that always, you know, provided some pretty interesting childhood experiences.
Wow. That's, you know, it's fascinating because those early experiences really shape us, right? And shape you. And we've watched your show and we've seen your family play a role in that show. So it just seems like, you know, if there were three words that described your childhood, what would those words be? Like what three words describe your upbringing with your family?
Creative, transient, because we moved a lot, like just from house to house. We had a lot of different homes because my parents flipped houses before flipping was trendy. So we were, you know, we were always kind of moving. And You know, I think like as an adult looking back on my childhood, a lot of it has been defined by feeling, I guess, sort of alone in the world. Like, I, when you talk about, when you think about attachment styles and how, when we're raised as children and how it affects us as adults, I realized as an adult that I am an avoidant attacher because, you know, when we were kids, our parents were very involved in the church and that, and almost it was more important to them than being there for us, like individually as children. And so as a child, whenever I was upset or needed comforting, I didn't really go to my parents. I just kind of went to myself or went to my room. And so, you know, that translated in over the years of in my 20s, probably in particularly feeling like I was really out there on my own. And in order to make things happen and to, you know, have the career that I wanted to, I really had to do it myself because nobody else was going to be there for me or do it for me. So, you know, there's positive things to that and negative things to that. But as a mother, I really want my daughter to be a secure attacher. And so, you know, I was able to kind of reflect on how I was brought up as a child and then think about how I want a parent and how that can be different for her.
I think that kind of analyzing that is so important to do because we're just so unaware of how our early years affect us going forward, right? And I know that for myself, I was similar to, not necessarily specifically avoidant, but you know, in that feeling or that idea that you can do it all or you have to do it all on your own. Mm. And so then you sort of don't reach out for help or you don't look outside or you don't trust that somebody else could necessarily do it for you. Do you think that that was part of your experience as well, especially as you started to grow up and try to form relationships?
Mm-hmm. I think I was already innately pretty determined and goal-driven, motivated type of person. So, you know, my dad described me even as a baby, seeing me in the, you know, the church nursery, and I would spot like a Cheerio in the corner of the room, and I would crawl over every other baby in the room to get to the Cheerio. So he knew like right from the time I was a baby, I don't have to worry about Rebecca. She's going to make it happen for herself. And when we were kids, my dad, even every day when he dropped us off at school, his catchphrase that he used for us was make it happen. Mm. So, you know, I think I've always had a little bit of like the gumption, the nerve to just kind of put myself out there to do things on top of like, I like to call them rose colored safety glasses of the construction business, but, you know, being able to like pick myself up from by my bootstraps when I get down and keep moving forward. So like, you know, there is a little bit of that inner confidence, inner determination that I was born with. It was kind of natural. And then having to learn and adapt as you get older. And for me, because I was a musician and in my 20s and I've always been an artist, I'm the artistic one in the family. I'm a little bit of the black sheep when it comes to me and my siblings, you know, having that outsider perspective, feeling like you're a little different, feeling like nobody will really understand you. Like those are the challenges that I had to overcome throughout, you know, to get to where I am now. Mm. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with the ego and how do we quiet the ego so that we don't, so that it doesn't take over and control our decision-making process.
Wow. Yeah. You can tell you've done a lot of inner work, you know, that you spent time reflecting on your experience and drawing meaning from it and fueling it into the work you're doing now. It's that's really evident. And it's interesting just how, you know, we're kind of planted, even though there's challenges in that there's lots of things that come out of it, right? Like your creativity, you know, you had parents who were flipping houses and how wonderful that's turned out for you and your life. And then learning to be on your own and to make things happen and all the success that you've created for yourself in your career. That musical upbringing too, you talked about being in church singing. And so you took that, and maybe that was innate to you, this love of music, but you did pursue music for a little while. You even lived here in Toronto with us. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your time as a musician.
Yeah. So, I grew up in a very musical family
Hey, sorry, I'm just doing a recording right now, so we have to keep everybody quiet.
Sorry, I've got a lot of people putting it in my head.
We can edit.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so yeah, I started playing piano as a little girl, and then I inherited my grandfather's violin. So my grandfather, my father's side, was a master violinist, and so I was the only one in the family that played the violin. So I got my grandfather's violin. And then as I got older, and I went away to boarding school for a brief period of time to a Christian boarding school in Saskatchewan. And so I played the violin and sang in the worship team at my Christian high school. And then when I was in university, that's when I first picked up a guitar and taught myself how to play guitar and started writing songs. So so music has always been a part of my life, and I was in theater and I wanted to be an actress, but I got a lot of opposition from my teachers and from just experience at that time. Like, for women, I guess for me, what seemed to, I was feeling quite depleted and like I was never, acting wasn't going to really be a good career choice for me. So I started writing songs about my sadness. And then I started performing those songs. And then I went to Toronto and recorded my first album with a producer there. And then I got signed to Outside Music in Toronto and got a really great agent, and got booked on all kinds of great tours and shows, and got to open for a lot of exciting people. And then wanting to always be different and challenging and doing something unexpected, I started Ruby Jean and the Thoughtful Bees, which was an electronic dance band, and we played and toured and played a lot of festivals and a lot of party scenes and a lot of debauchery through that band. And then when I moved to Toronto, life kind of spiraled or like became distracting, because in Toronto, like a lot of the, as opposed to being in Halifax, I could be an artist and a musician, and there's a lot of grants and support here. But in Toronto, I kind of found myself in the rat race, and there's a lot more people doing it. There's a lot more competition. There's a lot more scarcity, I guess, mentality. And so I was waitressing and making money waitressing, and kind of found myself in a difficult situation and got pregnant. And then after I had my daughter, I wanted to make a change, and I didn't want to be sleeping on floors anymore touring. I wanted to have more of a consistent space for her to grow up in, and for me to, get my life back on track. And so I was fortunately able to move back to Nova Scotia and rebuild and restart a new life for us here. And that's when I transitioned into the DIY mom brand. I mean, there was a lot of steps in between that and getting to where I am now, but for the most part, it was just taking baby steps in that direction and seeing opportunities and taking them as they came up. And then, yeah, this is where I am now.
It's interesting that you're talking about, sleeping on floors, because the musician, especially early days, lifestyle is so specific. Like, we really can, it's been played out in movies and stuff like that, and you can see it. But, it is a very different lifestyle. And I'm wondering if there's any element of that, or the freedom, or the I don't know, even the singing, if there's parts of that you miss about yourself and about the experiences that you had.
Performing and singing and music is still important to me. And I wish that I spent more time just at the piano or with my guitar and playing, because, I do believe that it elevates my frequency. It keeps me creative. It keeps me open. It helps me connect with other people. So, whenever somebody asks me, would you get out your guitar and sing? I'm like, sure. Wow. Great. Thanks for asking. I was just waiting for somebody to ask me, of course. And so when those opportunities come up, I still really enjoy them, because they do, music is a life force, and it's important just to always be expressing, for me, it's important to always be expressing my creativity, whether it is through design and color and home decor or making TV episodes or editing, or, you know, writing and playing music or painting or drawing. Anything creative is always going to fuel my soul.
Mm, beautiful. Yeah. And one podcast we listened to, we heard you say even pottery, you were really into pottery for a while. So you're totally a lot of creative pursuits.
Yeah. That was one of the best things I think about the boarding school that I went to. I had an art teacher who built all these pottery wheels. They were like old kick wheels out of a half a tire and a big cement block, and you'd sit on it and you'd kick it and you'd turn the pottery. And I became so engrossed in it. Like, I loved it so much that I, you know, burnt through all the pottery that we were given as students. So then I would buy extra pottery and I would come after school and I would make pottery after school. And I think by the time Christmas came around, I had made 75 pieces. Wow. And everybody in my family got a mug for Christmas.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, and thinking of just, you're in Toronto pursuing music and you get pregnant, right? And so, you know, a lot of people might have seen that as a setback, but somehow you're able to say, well, I'm going to go back home. I'm going to take a job that won't require me to travel. You know, I'll get into film or TV or something that's still creative, but that suits my lifestyle better. And that really just shows, you know, you didn't go into, it just shows resilience, right? For a lot of people, that might have been a really hard setback and something that might have affected them for a long time. But yet you just turned around, you went with it, and you created something like amazing for your life, which we'll get into. But so, you know, what is it in you? How were you able to do that? To take a setback and turn it into, take lemons and turn it into lemonade. How are you?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of therapy. I've read a lot of self-help books. I've taken, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. So I try to take it all in and I really try to internalize it and make myself better. I think I've always been on a quest for finding purpose, for leading a purpose-driven life, for exploring my passions and for always improving and always, you know, becoming my best self. You know, in some ways, the Christian upbringing does teach you like that you do need to rely on a higher power, that there is something bigger than you, that you do, that the work, the internal work is never ceasing. It's, and you always have to do the work and you always have to reconnect to the source in order to fulfill your greatest destiny and to be, you know, the person that you were meant to be. So, you know, there was a little bit of that was ingrained in me. I understood that I am not perfect, that I need help and that I need to ask for help or get help. And I did some really effective self-help books that like The Tools. I don't know if you're familiar with The Tools. Mm-hmm. That one was really great. There's like specific exercises for creative types that help you to kind of get out of the cycle. I read the book Calling in the One, which also helped me deal with some of my past traumas.
I'm taking notes.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, ex-boyfriends and hurt that I had experienced and through my childhood and, you know, my relationship, actually realizing that my relationship with my sister was probably one of them that most affected me. And then I also did EMDR therapy. Mm-hmm. And that actually really changed me because I was able to let go of some of these sort of, I guess, as you guys would call them, limiting beliefs, like these things that I really believed about myself, you know, that I was permanently damaged and unlovable and all these things. And I was able to kind of let those things go. I had to do a lot of work internally. Yeah. And surround myself with people that help me get to that place in my life as well.
Mm-hmm. It's that like digging deep that actually really helps you move forward, right? It feels like kind of a setback because you're going back in time. And I think a lot of us avoid that because it is so difficult. I too did EMDR and it was life-changing.
Yeah.
So I can totally relate to that, how it's you know, changes your perspective on so many things without even actually necessarily talking about those things. It just, it just opens up so much for you. I'm curious about your sense of spirituality, because you still seem to have that. And if you're still religious, are you still kind of following your religious roots, or have you opened or expanded into something different? Do you go to church on Sundays?
Yeah. Well, after probably 10 years of not really being involved in a church, I got back into it, and I started to get involved in church again. And so I am part of a church community out in Nova Scotia called Nova Church, and it's very modern. You know, it's very, you know, spirit led and encouraging, and I've been able to make some really great friendships from that. I host a small group. It got shut down because of the COVID regulations again, but part of the reason why I wanted to renovate a house and have a great place to host people was to have deeper connections and deeper relationships with other Christian women, and to be able to have them over and to mentor and to support other young women that are looking to nurture their faith and their spiritual growth. And for me, being able to talk about those things with other women, you know, it's more so for me than even is for the other people, because I know that it's important for me to talk daily about my relationship with Jesus and my faith. And I listen to, you know, daily, I'm listening to the daily audio Bible right now. So I'm going through the Bible in 1 year. So even going back to a lot of the scriptures and the parables and things that I learned as a child, and being able to look at them with a fresh eyes and find the new applications for where I am in my life now has been really, really amazing. I also do meditation, and you know, I've read many different books from different spiritual sides of things. So there are a lot of threads in various religions that are, you know, that are similar. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's more of like I really believe in compassionate, deep listening and hearing other people's perspectives and thinking about the ego, thinking about, you know, how we're projecting ourselves, how we're supporting other people. But most of all, it's like the big picture things for me that are meaningful, like how do I take like what I care about, making houses beautiful and designing spaces, and make it more about like this beautiful Instagram facade, but go a little bit deeper and actually improve the lives of people. So I think that's like the biggest takeaway from Christianity for me, is that it's not about me. It's about, you know, how can I influence and improve the lives of other people in my community?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you're inspiring because you're working towards physical human goals here in the real world that we live in, and also, you know, spiritual personal growth goals at the same time. And, you know, I do personally, and I know Julie feels the same way, I think we do need to do both. You know, both are important, and actually both support our mental well-being on this planet. It's really hard to feel mentally well if you're not kind of focused on both of those things. And it's just really inspiring to see how you do that and how you've managed to turn it into something that's really outwardly successful for you, but also, you know, inwardly enriching for you as well. And so thank you for sharing that with us. I know.
Yeah, for asking about it.
Yeah, it probably doesn't come out in your episodes.
No, you don't really get to talk about those things that often. I appreciate the questions because, you know, it's interesting. I'm like, just the other day I was listening to the Old Testament, you know, the stories about Jacob and, you know, and the decisions like that, basically that God uses imperfect people to do his work on this earth. And so even if I've made terrible decisions in my life, which I have, and even if I have tons of regrets, which I do, it doesn't discount me from actually being able to
do God's work in this world. He actually uses those imperfect people. Mm. But it kind of like brought me back to this place of being like, well, I don't want to go out there and date and like pick somebody, because I've picked the wrong men over and over again. And every time I end up suffering. And when I was listening to these Old Testament stories about, you know, working for 7 years, seven more years after they picked somebody to marry to get things right, or all the difficulties that were caused in their life by them by God allowing them to make their own choices, and then the repercussions of those decisions, I realized I better not like go out there and pick somebody else for me to date. I better just wait for God to like show me the exact right person for me, because otherwise I'll end up having to suffer for another 7 years, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I can get that. I don't want that for you either. I want some perfect guy that's delivered down to earth. And so, you know, with DIY Mom, that, you know, what you've been able to create there is just amazing. And so tell us a little bit about how that came about. You moved back to Halifax,
yeah.
You know, you're pregnant, you have a baby. So tell us a little bit about that transition out of music into this new career for yourself.
Yeah. So I was able to get back to Halifax, and my dad had a place that I could rent. And he gave me a bit of a, you know, needed to be fixed up. So I had some ideas in terms of how to fix up the kitchen space and the bathroom. And I, at the same time, I got a job at a production company here in Halifax called Egg Films. So I was working in the commercial industry, and I started to get sort of a sense of what it was like to work with clients, to be on set, you know, about the commercial world, about creating content for brands. And at that time, a lot of discussion was going into like what the next wave of marketing would be in branded content. Life outside of the 30-second commercial. And that's kind of got me thinking about like, oh, what would my brand be if I was going to create a brand or to create something? And I've always loved interior design and decorating. And when I was a kid, you know, when I was in university and in high school at my boarding school, they would call me the Trailer Park Martha Stewart, because I would take like some sheets and turn them into curtains, and I would take garbage bags and put them on the wall and have an electric circus party. So I was always doing creative things like that. And so I just started thinking about the idea of filming and editing and shooting little clips of me doing my own little fixer-upper design things around my house. And then I came up with the idea of DIY Mom, just because I liked the DIY and the MOM and the shape it made, and coming from a music scene where everything was DIY, and we always called what we did, like, you know, we create these DIY albums and all these other things. Mm. And so I kind of just liked the visual of it. And then the idea that I'm a single mom and I'm doing it myself. So I'm doing the solo parent thing on my own. And that's kind of like the DIY came through that. Mm-hmm. And then the mom. So I kind of put that together and started putting my little videos out there, and then realized, oh, maybe I could get the products that I need to make the things donated. And then, you know, that just grew from there until it became something that I could pay myself for, or have a TV show, or, you know, all these little things just kept coming through that. And I just kept saying, okay, yeah. And just going with the next thing as it came up, and it kind of just brought me to, you know, this place now. Mm-hmm.
So when you say, you know, you had these ideas and then you did, you know, the next step, this is all you on your own, right? It's not like you have this team yet of people. This is you on your own. And you're like, oh, I have an idea. What if this company sponsored me and I could get some free products? You're actually going out and sending them the email, or going and meeting them with them and asking them, like, this is all you doing all the work, correct?
Yeah. At that time, it was just me, and I was filming stuff on my iPhone and editing it on iMovie. And, you know, eventually I learned how to use Final Cut Pro. And then as things progressed, or I got bigger deals, and I like brought in a camera guy. It's funny because I got a job at the Atlantic Film Festivals after Egg closed, and the guy, I was working on a marketing team, and the guy wanted none of my ideas. He literally told me, you can just sit at the desk from 9 to 5. I don't care what you do. Like, cause I was hired through this government program. They were paying me anyway. And I was so frustrated because I kept coming up with these ideas and he would say he doesn't want them. So he's like, I don't care what you do. Just, you know, don't bug me, basically. So while I was at that job, I created a website for DIY Mom. I drew the logo. I wrote a pitch. I applied to this pitching program. And then I got in front of all these women at this Women in Film and Television conference. And I pitched DIY Mom with my little 2-year-old on my hip at that time. And, you know, all these years later, in the fall, I was doing a producer's workshop for Film Nova Scotia. And the woman who was doing the training with us said, I remember your pitch that you did at Women in Film and Television. She's like, I have literally seen thousands of pitches and, you know, never would remember anything, but I remember yours. Yours was so memorable. And I always thought there was something to this and that, you know, so basically, you know, championing me. Getting mixed up. But that was, you know, so that was great, like a full circle moment, you know, to come back to that. So yeah, it was just like, it was just the idea, the building of the website. And then as opportunities came up, just saying yes to them, because of these little YouTube videos that I was making, I got asked by another production company if I would be a co-host on a show called Eyes for the Job. And it was me and a blind carpenter, and it was being created for AMI. So I did one season of that show, but it was really hard for me because they didn't want any of my creative ideas. They didn't want to use my designs. And so it just didn't feel authentic to me. And, you know, authenticity is a big thing for me. And I really wanted, I felt like I had an important vision to share. I felt like my designs were, you know, more true to me. And so at that time, Bell was looking for new content, and one of the local producers came and asked me, would you like to do a show with, you know, for DIY Mom on Bell? And that's when that opportunity kind of came up, and I started to do that. And I also bought the house, my old house that I sold, that I did for season 1 and season 3 at that time. So I had a great project to work on. And then that's when I started to put together a team and bring people in to work with me, and help, you know, the production run smoother, the editing be better, the camera work be, you know, more professional. So, you know, it was a slow grow, but then, you know, it just kept going.
I love the end of that episode with your mom, and she's so proud of you, right? She's just like, so excited. She's so proud of you.
My parents lived with me and my daughter after we finished that house too. So for season 1, which I'm not sure if it's still available on Bell, but it was a really fun season because my parents were really involved in that and they were living with me. So I had I have always had a close relationship with my parents in terms of, you know, the three of us as siblings, you know, because my parents are creative. They, you know, they did do a lot of flipping and designing and stuff. And I think also because I need them the most help, like I'm the only one without a partner. So, you know, there probably is a bit of, that they are involved, more involved in my life, you know, based on me being a single mother. But there is like a closeness and a kinship that I share with my parents because we do share similar artistic passions. Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, thinking about the time where you bought that first house and you were doing the videos on YouTube. And, you know, just it's a big investment, right? And a big project. That house, you know, I saw the before pictures. That was a lot of work that you put in. Yeah. And, you know, you had a young child. And as you said, you're a single parent on your own. And this was before the Bell TV deal, right? So, I mean, just shows an incredible amount of, I guess, gumption and risk tolerance and all of that. And, you know, how did you get yourself through that period? Was there at any point where you were like, what am I doing? I've taken on this big project. I've never done this kind of thing before. How did you get yourself through that period?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of questioning about, especially like from men that would come on the site too. They would often question me and wonder why, like, you know, who do, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. And I think there's a few like things that kind of came out of it. One was I realized how lucky I was to be in the position where I could afford to put money back into my property and to buy a home. You know, I had parents that were supportive of me and helped me get my first mortgage, which was, you know, which a lot of people don't have. The Halifax market was extremely affordable. So, you know, I bought a house for $280,000.
Wow.
And so that's just not something you'd be able to do in Toronto.
No.
So that I was very fortunate for that. And then I was able to leverage my connections and the sponsors in order to get a lot of the things that I needed to do the work, you know, on trade. And so then I really just had to put money back into the labor, into hiring the right people and the carpenters and the other people and the plumbers and the electricians and all the things. So, and the permits and the beams.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it is like a mixture of being fortunate and having the right support network. And then also, like you said, the appetite for risk. And I definitely, because I came from a parents that took more risks, and a long line of actually risk takers and entrepreneurs. There's a lot of entrepreneurs in my family. My appetite for risk is a bit greater. And, you know, at the time when I was pouring all that money into my house, I didn't know if I was going to get it back. Like, it seemed like, oh, you know, how much is this house going to be worth at the end? Like, I didn't know that I would sell it for what I sold it for 3 years later. But, you know, now the Halifax market is insane. So, mm-hmm. So it just, the timing, you know, was perfect. And, you know, when I completed the renovations last summer, I didn't want to sell the house. I wanted to keep living in the house that I had created. And finally I could have some time off and rest and enjoy it. And everything just kind of lined up perfectly for this house. So I feel like I was just following the signs, and this new house, I actually saw it on the market. I put an offer in on it, and the day it was sitting on the market forever. And the day I put an offer in on it, somebody else put an offer in on it.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't get the house. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess that wasn't meant to be. I'll stay in my house a little longer. And my daughter was away visiting her family in Ontario. And then I, a couple weeks later, I noticed that the house was back on the market, and called my sister. I was like, what is going on? When did the real estate agent tell you? And she was like, oh, newbie realtor, you know? And I said, put my offer back in. So they put my offer back in, and then I got it. And the same day that I put the offer in on this house, I checked my email, and somehow I'd missed an email from Bell signing me on for season 4. I'd like missed the contract and everything. So
amazing.
I was 2 days. So then I responded to that, and I signed that contract, and then I decided to list my house. So that all happened on one day. So I really felt like it was meant to be, and that, you know, God was leading me to this house, and this was the next big project for me. So I just kind of went with my gut instinct.
I love that. That's so good. You mentioned, you know, when you were first starting in particular, you know, being surrounded by men. And being in this place of like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but they're questioning what you are doing. So I'm wondering if you did have a lot of sort of that sexism, that experience with, you know, being put down or being made to feel small when you first started out in particular, you know, in that industry.
Well, one thing that always threw me for a loop is that I would hear the guy saying, oh, she's really giving us a lot of trouble today, or she's, and I was like, what am I doing? What do you mean? I'm giving you trouble. What are you talking about? And they're like, oh no, we refer to the tools as she. So whatever they're working with. So, yeah. I was like, oh, okay. So they're not talking,
they're not talking about you. That's hilarious.
You know, and then just finding, like, when my dad was there helping me with the first season, that everybody would always go to him to ask him what stuff that they should be coming to me. And the same thing, I found with this new house is that one of my lead carpenters that was here, the, you know, one of the men, that everybody else that came to do work would always go to him to ask what they should do or what was supposed to happen, and they weren't coming to me. And he, being a peacemaker and trying to keep the peace, would often tell them, oh, it's okay, you can go, I'll finish that up for you. And I had to be like, no, they have to come to me and check to make sure it's okay for them to leave, because otherwise I've already paid them to do that job, and I have to pay you to do that job too. So there's a lot of times where I think people just don't want to come and talk to me because they know they're not going to like the answer. But I don't know if that's a woman thing or not.
Yeah, I think, you know, so Julie and I, we co-own a yoga studio. And so we've just, you know, yes, we're closed. We're thinking about our business a lot. And I kind of just want to lay out your business model for a minute, because I just think it's so impressive. And so correct me if I'm misunderstanding this, but it sounds like you buy houses for, you know, lower prices, right? And then you get sponsors to help contribute financially and give you material so you can renovate the house. And you're being televised at the same time, which I imagine increases the value of the house upon resale. And then you sell the house. And it's just like this brilliant business model that there's no way you could have sat in school and said, this is what I'm going to do for my life. Right?
No, it is a model that I kind of figured out as I went, but it's sort of like in thirds. So it's like, you know, I get the Bell deal pays for about a third of my production expenses. Then I get NSBI grants to film the show. And then I get sponsors to help me subsidize the renovation. And then I've used my previous house as leverage to get this house. So now that, you know, like once then I was able to sell that the previous house for enough to kind of help me renovate this house and do the next thing. So it's a constant like reinvesting back into my business. But the business model has worked for me, and it's kept me going, and it's helped me employ other people and make a TV show. But you know, it is a different style TV show than a typical HGTV show, because I am working on one place for the whole season. And even though each episode might be a different room or a different space, I'm still very hands-on in terms of working with all of the partners and the brands that I incorporate into the show. And then I use my social media as leverage as well to kind of make it sort of the package brilliant. More.
It's brilliant.
Well, your Instagram in particular is stunningly beautiful. I love looking at the images. It's like everything I want. I was like, I really just want to be best friends with Rebecca and have her come over and like, you know, zhuzh my house a little bit. And
That's going to be the next step, is I have to start doing other people's houses.
right. I know. And so where does your design inspiration come from? So where do you get it from? I mean, you know, I personally, you know, go on Pinterest or Google, whatever, but are you drawing from anything in particular?
For this house in particular, I actually ordered a lot of mid-century modern architecture books from the 1950s. And looked through those and studied them and developed kind of the architectural style for this home based on what I wanted to bring to it, because it was a 1950s bungalow on a slab in the hills of Halifax. It overlooks the basin, and the house had a lot of hallways and a lot of division. And so I really wanted to create an open concept space. It was great for hospitality. So I looked at all those old books and kind of tried to bring in some of those design inspirations, like the arches and the flush look. So I took away all the baseboards and all the trims around the windows to give it this more of a mid-century modern look. Mm-hmm. And when I was studying about mid-century modern, because, you know, I end up doing my own research for these things, three words really stuck out to me in particular. It was Scandinavian, pastel, and modern. And so those were the three things that I really wanted to incorporate into this house, because my last house, had more of like a farmhouse vibe, and it had a lot of black and whites. And I think it's important, you know, as a designer, to always be thinking of what's going to be in style 2 years down the road, mm-hmm. and projecting and creating new things so that when people look at my page, they find inspiration in it. It's something that they haven't seen before. Because, you know, at this point in my career, it's not so much about regurgitating stuff that I've taken. It's about creating a new vision, about creating a new design. And same thing with color, and picking fresh colors and picking the right colors, and then incorporating more colors into my home. Because I really felt like after, you know, the year of 2020 of being stuck in our homes, that people don't want to live in gray spaces or black and white spaces anymore. They want to incorporate color into their homes. So that was important for me to kind of like infiltrate those type of concepts that I learned. And like I was saying, when we first started about the color pink, realizing that when I came home every day to a pink front door and I stepped out of my car and I looked at that door, it lit me up. It made me feel happy inside. And so why not? Mm. Why not have a pink front door? And just picking those things that you know, make me feel alive. It's one of the things that I feel really I'm grateful for, or like the gift of being single in this period of my life, because it has enabled me to move quickly, to make big decisions, to make dramatic decisions, to choose colors that I am drawn to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I, you know, at this point in my life, I find that I have to be like grateful for, you know, my current situation of being single, and appreciate it and value it and do what I can with it. And, you know, hopefully that'll bring more blessing, more opportunity for me to keep going and doing what I'm doing.
I know there's one episode where you were like hammering or doing something and you were like, this is why I'm single. Like, you have so much work to do around you. And it's like, nobody needs to come into this mess. So,
you're certainly making use of all of the time, for sure. Amazing use of the time. Tell us a little bit about DIY Box, your charitable initiative.
Yeah. So, even like on social media and stuff, I'm always trying to think of ways to engage with my audience in a more purposeful way and to bring people in. And I, after, you know, the experiences I had in 2020, I had to flee an abusive relationship. So that really changed the way I looked at other single mothers or other women who have to use shelters and who are looking for affordable housing. I wanted to figure out a way to give back and to support the women in need. And with, you know, abuse being at an all-time, you know, high in terms of this, you know, being forced to stay at home, it's like become, it's created more opportunity, I guess, to keep women in an abusive situation. So I wanted to start to be more philanthropic in my work. And I came up with the idea for the DIY box as a way for people to order something that, you know, would improve their life, like starting a garden or a vegetable garden, and that the proceeds would go towards charities in my community that help single women or women flee abuse. And the idea for the first initial project was a mid-century modern greenhouse. So we used all the leftover wood from my kitchen renovation. And Julie, one of the girls that works with me, she's an industrial designer by trade and a woodworker. We worked together to create the design for the mid-century modern greenhouse and the instructions for how to build it. And then I curated the rest of the box, the gloves and the misters and the seeds, and worked with local shops and local suppliers to put it all together so that, you know, while people are stuck at home, they can order a box, it can be shipped to them, and they can put it together and build it at home and start, you know, their vegetable garden. So, that's kind of, I guess, where it came from and sort of blossomed from there.
I love that. I love that you are, you know, have this giving back, as you mentioned, right? Like that's sort of the Christianity, and what you've learned is to be of service to others as well. And the other thing that you do is you mentioned this before, is you mentor other women on your team. And it's so important for us to be women mentoring women, right? For us to be supporting like up and coming women. And I think that's so important. So I'm curious about who your mentors were, who you looked up to, or who were your role models for you.
Well, first, before I get into the role models, I just want to say that I love working with women. And you know, there's something really collaborative about the way that women work together. Mm-hmm. I call my production company Matriarch, and because you know, most of the people that I work with are women, but the way that the matriarch works is so much different than the patriarch. Like, there's not this idea of like somebody has to rise to the top and be the leader. When, you know, studies have shown that when women work together, they actually, there's more of like a, oh, what do you think? Oh, what do you, you know, we end up taking ideas from each other and working and building off of each other and bouncing ideas. And that there doesn't need to be a single person that rises to the top and is the boss. Mm-hmm. So I really love that aspect. I also find women are natural problem solvers. And that's the great thing about having Julie here with me, working on my renovations with me. So many times over the years when men have come to do a job, they are like, well, you didn't tell me I'd have to do that. I don't have that tool. I can't do it. And they leave and they don't want to do the job. Like, I always found there were so many excuses for why they couldn't do the job. And then when I got Julie here, she would just, if she needed something to do something, she would build it. She'd take a piece of wood and all of a sudden she's getting the, you know, the leverage that she needs, or she's really, you know, that type of problem solving that women innately have is just so wonderful to have on a job site or any site, a production site, wherever.
I just thought of that song, Henry, with the water bucket. Just, well, you know, I'll fix it. Like, just that one about,
oh, fix it, dear Eliza,
dear Henry, or whatever that song where he's not fixing the bucket. And she's like, just get this or this. And it keeps coming over. For
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember having an argument with a guy the first season of DIY Mom. He's like, well, I can't do that. I don't have the tools for that. I was like, well, do you have something that cuts? Do you have something that cuts? Do you have something that
tools?
You
know?
Yeah. You can do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole, I mean, I get it why people are like, you need the right tool for the job, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, a little ingenuity and creativity goes on too.
Yeah, for sure.
So I was, you know, I've had various mentors throughout the years, like, you know, in music, in production, in other ways, but, one of my friends, I've always been drawn to women that are like in their 60s. I love older women friends. And one of my best friends is Kathy Jones. So she's a comedian and she's been on This Hour's 22 Minutes for 35 years. And she's an icon. And she started, you know, the Newfoundland comedy, you know, that whole, I forget the name of the troupe that she was in, but I mean, they were a groundbreaking comedy troupe from Newfoundland. So she's really mentored me over the years. She's the one that introduced me to the tools, and that kind of helped me look at myself with a lot more compassion. Mm-hmm. And she's also walked me through, she's the one that introduced me to EMDR. Just a lot of like, communicating and therapy suggestions and meditation recommendations and all these things. She's Buddhist as well, so she comes from a different spiritual side, I guess, of things. So Kathy's been a big inspiration for me. You know, other women that have come alongside me and have encouraged me. My mother has been always a great mentor to me. My grandmother was an absolute saint. she, you know, so the women in my family that have encouraged me, and just the books and the podcasts that I listen to that are female centered, and those things have also helped to mentor me. I guess like if somebody is willing to care about you and support you and have some great advice, then I'm like a sponge. I'm like, bring it on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, so you talk about matriarch and this long line of powerful women that have influenced you. And then you've also got this little woman that you're influencing. And, you know, you brought up your daughter before in this conversation. And, you know, what kind of things are you hoping to impart on her? What do you hope that you impart on her?
Well, you know, there's hard work and perseverance are big ones that I you know, I want to show her that. You know, money just doesn't grow on trees. You got to work hard for it, of course, but also connecting to other people, working well with other women, encouraging, complimenting people, you know, just in general, when I talk to her too, I like, if I notice that she's being snarky or she's having a hard time connecting with me, you know, oftentimes it's, I'm the one that's made the connection difficult. When they're children, you know, they need us to be the example of what mature adult relationship looks like. And I'm not always the best at that. I'm certainly working hard at it, but just even reminding her, like, are you pushing mommy away? Or are you bringing me closer? Mm-hmm. And realizing that we do need other people, that we do need connections, because, you know, even though I've been single and I've been able to go fast and do things, I love the African proverb. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. So I'm trying to instill this idea of togetherness with her, that we need other people, that we are not islands, that we're meant for connection, that as humans, we need to connect with other people. So those are important things that I want to instill in her, and that she can do anything that she wants, that there are no limitations for women, that we can be who we want. We can do what we want. We can be CEOs. We can be software engineers. We can be computer programmers, or we can be artists. Mm-hmm. And that nobody is going to make her successful. She has to find her success herself.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. I imagine you would likely say a lot of those things to yourself as a younger woman, young girl. But what specifically would you say to your 15-year-old self?
To my 15-year-old self, listen. You know, I think I developed my listening skills a little late in life. I was a talker when I was a kid, and then, you know, I've become quieter as I got older, but I always thought, oh, I should have gotten listen tattooed on my wrist. Mm-hmm. I have my grandmother's signature tattooed on my wrist, but I should have gotten listen on the other one. And I think it would have helped me avoid a lot of pain that I caused for myself from, you know, my ego, in my 20s. And when, you know, when I got hurt or when bad things happened to me, feeling like letting those things really get me down, practicing, learning mindfulness and having practiced mindfulness earlier in my life might have helped me to find success a little younger, because it took me a while to get to where I am today, and a lot of things that helped me.
One of the other questions we like to ask our guests is, what is your afterglow? And by afterglow, we mean, you know, what is the vision you have for yourself, the future vision you have for yourself that's really connected to your heart and the truth of who you are? And so not anyone else's definition of success, but your own. And sometimes it might feel a little bit scary because it, you know, it requires all your superpowers to implement. What would your afterglow, what's your afterglow?
Well, I have really felt like I've been called to do something to help other single mothers. And I've been sort of building this idea in my mind of creating a new model for affordable housing. So where I want to go with my career and what I want to do next is to do affordable housing for single mothers that would give people opportunity, community, safety and protection, and support that women need. Because, you know, I had a friend recently that was driving me around to the affordable housing in Halifax, and affordable housing is a huge issue in Halifax. We have, you know, less than 1% vacancy. The rent prices have gone up tremendously, and there's just no affordable housing for women. And the affordable housing that is there, they're all kind of clustered together in these areas that are not necessarily like where I realized, like, when I fled in my abusive situation and I got to the top of the road and I was at the stop sign, I didn't know where I was going to go. I was going to turn right. I was going to go to a shelter. I was going to turn left and go see my family. And I didn't know which one I wanted to do. I didn't want to necessarily put it on my family. But I realized at that moment, like, it gave me, I realized, like, if it wasn't me, if I wasn't in that situation, I didn't have a place to go. Like, I would have to rely on these shelters and affordable housing. So luckily in my situation, I've been able to provide for myself and my daughter. But if I wasn't in that position, I was honestly like, I wouldn't want to be living in those places. I don't want to be living next to the drug dealers and the things that are going on in that area that may be very negative for your child to grow up in. I want my daughter to be in a safe place with nature and with, so why are these places being reserved for the wealthy or just for the people of privilege? So my goal would be to create a community for single mothers that is in a safer, maybe more rural area and with lots of outdoor space and place for people to grow and opportunity for women to go back to work, to take a trade, to give back to the community, to work for the community, to work for Matriarch or the organization, and to have homes that are beautiful for them, that feel like that they reflect their inner personality, and that they take pride in and that they want to care for and make, so that it will make their life and their children's lives better. Because in many ways, like if owning a house is like the best way for somebody to improve their life, to own property. But if you can't necessarily own a house, or if that's not affordable or feasible, or to create affordable housing, they have to be renting. The next way for them to improve their life would be to get education, to get good jobs and opportunity, but also to change the path for their children so that their children can have the opportunities that maybe they didn't have, in the inner city life, or, so get them out of the situation that they're in and get them into a new place. So that's like really where I'm feeling passionate about. And the more I say it out loud and the more I talk about it, the more people seem to come up and say, oh, I'm passionate about that too. How can I help? And so I'm going to be putting together a think tank of women, of people that work with affordable housing in the past, of people that work at shelters, people that are passionate about fundraising or about women, opportunity for women, and bring them all together and create a new model. And then based on what we create and if there's success in that program, being able to give it to other communities and other places of the country and say, here, this worked for us here in Nova Scotia. Why don't you try that in Winnipeg or try that in Vancouver? Sort of like write the new handbook for affordable housing for single mothers. So that's where I'm hoping to go.
That's a nice big afterglow. And I don't think it's an unattainable. I think that it's going back to really your true authentic self and who you are in that giving back and being of service, which you've, talked about and demonstrated through your career, but also in this podcast, it's just like shown so much. So thank you for that. That is beautiful. If we had more time and maybe on a different podcast, I would actually go and get you to get your guitar and get you to sing.
Oh, yeah.
Just to show all of the aspects of who you are. It's such a beautiful thing. And I'm hoping that there's like a pottery line coming out of this at some point. And
I didn't even build myself one of those wheels that Mr. Ginter had in Saskatchewan for myself so that I can go into the shed and kick some pottery around. Because it really is like the tactileness of like holding clay in your hand and turning it into something. It's so good for the mind and for the spirit and for your body too. I just gotta make myself a pottery wheel.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's really just sticking out how you've just gone through and pulled all the threads of your life and have just sewn it into something really beautiful and impactful, and really excited to see where your afterglow leads. It's a beautiful, inspiring vision, and we need more leaders like you, more people like you. So really grateful you shared your time with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me and for your podcast, and that you're encouraging other women and talking about these ways that we can grow and fulfill our true authentic selves and have deeper connections with the world and the people around us. So I appreciate that.
We're pleased to announce that the Richards Group is a proud sponsor of this episode of the Afterglow podcast. The Richards Group is not just any other real estate agency. They do everything from coming in and meeting you, staging your home, storing your furniture, and finding your new place that you're going to live. We're so proud to have the Richards Group as our sponsor because it's not just a robotic communication or interaction. They are like family. So thank you to the Richards Group.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know, what do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.